I think I titled the lesson Talking to Kids About Judgment, but it's not strictly speaking just judgment. It's the beginning of our conversation about what in technical terms is called eschatology, which means last things. What happens at the end? What are Christians expecting to happen at the end? We're going to do this kind of in two parts. Today we're going to look at a question of judgment, of resurrection, Christ coming back, that kind of conversation. And then, if I remember right, next week the plan is to do where do we all end up kind of question. How do you talk about heaven, hell, alternatives, and what are we supposed to talk about when we talk to kids about that topic? So that'll be more next week, which is interesting to me. I don't think a lot of Christians understand this topic, let alone children. So I'm happy to kind of get into that with you, and we'll do a little investigation. Maybe it'll help you too. With kids, we don't spend a lot of time talking about eschatology. My favorite Greek joke, if anybody wants to hear it, is that we spend a lot more time talking to kids about scatology, which is Greek for study of poop. We spend a lot more time in scatology than we do eschatology with kids. That's the more common subject matter. But for our purposes, we want to try some of this eschatology business. And today, three topics: second coming, resurrection, and judgment. So, Christ, Christians have a belief, a doctrine of Christ's second coming. How would you explain that to a kid? Give me some terminology that might help. Don't overthink it.
He's coming back.
Jesus is coming back, right? And so the hardest part is actually for adults, because you have a view of history, right? So you look at Jesus is coming back, and it's been like 2,000 years, and we're waiting. And so for adults, that's kind of a challenging concept. How long are we supposed to wait around for this? Kids don't have a view of history like that. They don't get... But a lot of them don't understand that the Gospels didn't happen like last weekend. So for them, Jesus coming back is actually an easier concept to just say, Jesus is coming back. And he's coming back for a reason. He's not just coming back because he is. He's coming back for us, right? There is an intent, a purpose for that. Resurrection. When Jesus returns, Christians believe we'll have the resurrection. How do we explain that? Don't overthink it. Zombies. I saw that. Yes. Zombie apocalypse. You are absolutely right. The dead will live again. Right? Don't make it any more complicated than it has to be. The dead will live again. This is a doctrine that gets skipped a lot of times, sadly, I think, in Christian teaching. We want to go right from death, and then I want to be in heaven. Right? Don't worry about anything else. And in the scriptures, I'll just give you a foretaste of next week. It's actually very difficult to get a doctrine of heaven and hell from verses. Like, there aren't a lot of passages where it says, let's now talk about heaven and hell. There are tons of passages about the resurrection. So you ask yourself, which one was more important to the early church in terms of doctrine? The dead will live again was the big deal. That was the keynote. And then something happens after that. But the dead live again was the big issue. And the reason it was such a big issue is because the first body was out of the ground. Jesus had been raised, so this was no longer hypothetical. God has the power to raise the dead, and he did once. So now we can talk about that more meaningfully. And then judgment. At the resurrection, Christ comes back, and everybody stands in front of the judge. And how do we explain that one to kids? We needed more coffee this morning, obviously. God will look at every human life. You don't have to use human life. You don't have to be every person. And consider what they've done. Okay? You don't have to read too much into it. It's not really complicated. God's going to look at what you've done. God's going to look at what everybody's done, actually. Okay? So let's flesh those out in a little more detail. And we're going to start with the story of Christ coming back. This comes from Acts 1, 10 through 11. Jesus is ascending to heaven and disappears behind a cloud somewhere. And it says, and while they were gazing into heaven as he went, behold, two men stood by in white robes, and said, Men of Galilee, why do you stand looking into heaven? This Jesus who was taken up from you into heaven will come in the same way as you saw him go into heaven. So another doctrine we don't talk a lot about is the doctrine of the ascension, that yes, Jesus risen from the dead, and also he ascended. And the reason that's so important in early church documents is because they understood Christ coming back as just the implication of the ascended. He went up, he's coming back. And it was supposed to be kind of the same thing. He went up, he's coming back. And it was just that simple. You believe one, you believe the other. So those beliefs were connected. So what kind of metaphor could we talk about? I think for younger kids especially, second coming is kind of like coming home for dinner. So if any of you, if you're like in our situation where you got two parents who are kind of working outside the home, or even one, when do you have dinner? When everybody gets home. I mean, it kind of depends. You'd like to say it'll be at this moment, and you try to wait for everybody to get home. Sometimes it doesn't work out that way. But in a perfect world, you wait till everybody gets home, and then you set out dinner. Now, sometimes people have to work late. So at Celine's work, they had one person take another job, and then another person was encouraged to resign, if that makes sense. And so they went from like having five assistants to having three. And so Celine, who's supposed to be part-time, is now kind of like overtime. And so instead of getting home in a reasonable time and, you know, we'll have dinner, it's like, good gravy, when is she going to get here? When I don't even know when to start dinner, let alone when are we going to put her on the table? So what if the kids come? For the kids, they come and it's like forever, right? You know, oh, I'm dying, I haven't eaten in 1,000 years, and I'm so hungry, and when is mom going to get home? And it's like, she's 15 minutes late, get over it. You know? But for kids, that kind of impatience is really easy to understand. No, it never happens soon enough. Okay, and so there's this waiting, and it seems like forever. But when they get here, there's this beautiful rejoicing, you know, yay, dad's home, yay, mom's home, you know, hey, now let's eat, right? And it's not so much you as it was the food, but never mind. Like parents who come home from work to share time with family, Christ is accomplishing something in his role as king and high priest and all those things. He's busy taking care of us, and one day he's coming back to get us. Okay, those are actually his words in John 14. I go to prepare a place for you. I have no idea what that entails, but he seems to think he's going to be busy. He's got stuff going on, and when it's the right time for him to do it, and I don't know what the schedule is. Do kids understand your schedule? During the last time you were late, the last time Celine was really late, they added a patient. She was supposed to be getting off at 5, and they added a patient who is scheduled to start at 5. So if your root canal starts at 5, right, the dental assistant whose job is to clean everything up after the root canal is not going to get home at 5:15. So how do I explain that to Lucas a little? Never mind Calvin, right? Well, okay, so there's a patient, they're in a lot of pain, and they don't get it. They just get, it's ridiculous, they don't love us. Okay. But instead, you try to convey to your kids, yeah, I know it feels like it takes forever, but we're going to be really happy when they get home. And it's expected and it's certain. So this is in a stable home environment. We know the parents are going to come home. Okay, parents, that's a big deal for you to communicate. That kind of stability with your kids is really both important and difficult. My dad's mother passed when he was 8 years old. And his dad was kind of not the most trustworthy chap. We have a picture of him in uniform. We're not sure he was in the military. We're fairly certain it's a penitentiary uniform, but in any event, he was sketchy. Okay? And one day, he takes my dad down and his little brother, who was in a stroller, okay, and he drops them off at the post office, says, I'm going to go do some errands, I'll be back in an hour. You kids hang out here. And he didn't see his dad again for a month. So in that environment, it's hard to tell kids, you should trust Jesus is coming back for you. I can't even trust dad to come back, right? So in your home, when you build trust and certainty, the kids just expect, my parents are going to be there eventually. They're going to be there, and it's okay. And that's the kind of trust we want to give to Christ. I mean, they're going to be there. Doesn't mom always come home? Yeah, okay. So she hasn't, like, just skipped town yet, has she? No, she's always here for dinner. Okay, so can we be patient? Yeah. Jesus hasn't left us yet. It does seem like it takes forever, but it's worth waiting for. So I think that's a good way to talk about it. It makes something they experience almost on a daily basis and forget. Like, the next day, we relive the whole thing. It's like, yesterday, we had this conversation. But anyway.
So if you're the parent that takes longer to come home, is it okay to maybe stay out a little bit later sometime?
Really basically, you're that? Teaching faith, I think. Yeah, yeah, by hanging out with the fellas and staying out late. Sorry. Yeah. Yeah. You go with that. Next week, how to talk to your kids about divorce. 1 Thessalonians 4:16 through 17. For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a cry of command, with the voice of an archangel, with the sound of the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first. Then we who are alive, who are left, will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. So we will always be with the Lord. Okay, so that's a fairly nice description of what we're expecting. The keynote in there is that he is coming back so that we can be with him. That's the end goal. He's coming back so that we can be with him. In fact, it's kind of, if you look at it carefully, we will be caught up together with them in the air. So imagine your favorite sentimental romantic movie, and they see the one they love across the field, and do they wait? And they're like, no, like they run to each other, right? And that's kind of, Jesus comes down, and we just meet him in the air. We go out to see him, right? And that's kind of the image. I like the idea of thinking of Jesus' return as a homecoming, right? That there's someone who has been separated, and we think, you know, today's weekend of Veterans Weekend and all this, right? We have kind of on our mind. That we assume that there is some reason for it. Do kids understand it? Go ahead, explain to your kids Mideastern politics and why a soldier needs to be deployed somewhere. And what do you say? You say something that's maybe yes or no helpful, like, well, they're fighting for, what do you say, our freedom or something like that, because that's the best you can do. And is that a concept that translates? You barely understand it, and you're telling your kids that, and you're like, yeah, I guess it's important. They're doing something important. And you say that because that's the best you can do. Why does it have to be my person that does that? Well, because that's the kind of person they are. They're taking care of it. So you think about how you have that conversation, and then how exciting and thrilled you are when that person comes home. And you don't say, oh, good, you're over there. Come on. You know, no, you run and tackle that person, and you don't let go. Right? So I think that's a good description. I don't want to, like, militarize the second coming. It's not an invasion as such, but it is like a family member coming home from deployment. We rush to meet them, and we never want to be separated again. And that's how that text ended. So shall we ever be with the Lord. There is something going on now, but when we come back together, we'll never part again. And that's the language there. So I think you can think of that as fairly emotionally laden language that might help you more than your kids. I don't know. But if your kids have experienced something like that, did you have kids while...
Stetson was 1 month old when he went on his last deployment.
Okay.
So, I mean, it was... Yeah.
So my brother-in-law, who got back from Afghanistan, well, let's see, he did one tour in Afghanistan and one in what we politely called Kuwaitistan, because he wasn't allowed to tell us exactly where he was, but he was in that Megiddo. And his kid was 6 months older than Calvin. Calvin was two at the time, so like 2.5. So mostly it was just simply aware that person isn't here, but communicating the idea. Now, wonder of wonder of the modern world, even from Ken's first deployment to the second deployment, the availability of like Skype and stuff like that, the world had changed in just that couple of years, where he was able to like FaceTime with his 2-year-old from parts unknown. So that was really cool. But before that, it was far worse. I mean, you really didn't have a great level of communication. But how do kids understand that? Probably not well. But however we try to explain that might help us explain this, is that we think Christ is coming back, he's doing something important, and when he comes home, we're going to put our arms around him and we will never let go. We will never be separated again, and it's going to be this spectacular moment. I think that's an important concept, because sometimes we overemphasize the next point I'm going to make, which is the judgment part. Jesus is coming back, you better get ready, right? Well, I'm not afraid of Jesus coming back. As a Christian, that's not like, oh, there's a test coming, you know, I better pass the exam, I better study up. As a Christian, the goal is, that is the best possible thing that could ever happen. It's Christ coming back. I want that to happen. And so helping kids understand, yeah, there's some judgment attached to it, there's a whole thing going on, but we love Jesus. For us, it's a homecoming. For us, it's good. Okay. Questions on that part of it? Good so far? Okay. How about judgment? Go dig through the internets and find you some great medieval paintings of judgment scenes. And we have all these imaginations of all of human history on display, and the king and his throne, you know, looking down and judging people and casting people here and there. It's a scene that we love to imagine because it's like, what's that going to be like? And the Bible doesn't tell us a whole lot. Like it emphatically says it's going to happen. If the New Testament says anything, the dead will be raised and everyone will be judged. I mean, those things are absolute in the New Testament. But as far as details, you get these weird stories about sheep and goats, right? I mean, you don't get a lot of clear detail. Is there a lawyer present? Do I have an attorney? Someone asks, how are the dead raised? And with what kind of body do they come? You foolish person. What you sow does not come to life unless it dies. And what you sow is not the body that is to be, but a bare kernel, perhaps of wheat or of some other grain. But God gives it a body as he has chosen, and to each kind of seed its own body. So the first thing Paul wants us to know is, step one is the resurrection. When we meet Christ in judgment, what is tied to that is living and dead will be there. It's not just whoever happens to survive that long gets a judgment. Step one is the resurrection, all persons. But how does he describe it? They ask our question, what kind of body? And he says, you foolish person. I'm like, well, that's not nice. I had that question. But his point is, you actually know. And then he uses a metaphor. It's like he's talking to children when he talks to us. He says, when you plant a seed, what comes up is not the same thing that goes in the ground. It's the same, but it's different. And that's a weird, if I just said it that way, oh, it's the same, but different, you would just stare at me. But what Paul says is, no, you do this all the time. You plant corn to grow corn. But the kernel doesn't look like the stalk and ear. You don't put a stalk and an ear in the ground to get a stalk and an ear. You plant a kernel, and you get stalk and ear. So it's the same, and yet there is something different about it. Okay. So, what's the resurrection like? It's like a seed that grows. If ever you had the happenstance to be at a funeral my dad performed, when we get to the graveside, he always reads that passage, and he always says, today we're farmers. And we're going to plant a seed in the ground in the expectation that it will come back better than we planted it. And that's a perfectly good biblical description of what burial is. We're farmers today. So it appears to be dead. And you take a kernel, and the seed doesn't look very alive. It looks pretty dead. You put it in the ground, and then it seems to do nothing for a long time. So you plant stuff with kids, right? You go out, and they expect, like 5 minutes later, you're coming, right? And it's not how it works. You stare at it for a long time and nothing seems to happen. It seems really dead. And then one day, suddenly, something different comes up. And it just happens. And it's God-giving life. And it grows into something more beautiful than the original. And it's especially useful planting flowers. Paul uses, you know, grains and corns, but planting flowers, and you put this little dinky thing in the ground, and then this beautiful thing grows out of it. And it's the same thing. I mean, you planted a rose, you got a rose, but it's also better. And that's the way Paul describes the resurrection. Your body will come back. It will be you. And it will be better than you. It'll be the best possible version of you, resurrected. In the same way, when Jesus comes back, it's kind of weird. When you read the accounts of the resurrection of Jesus, most of them start out by people not recognizing Jesus. Why do you not recognize him? You knew him 3 days ago. Because it's him, but it's not him. It's a resurrected Jesus. It's absolutely his body. I mean, if you go to the tomb, there's not the old version of Jesus sitting on a slab. Like, it's absolutely him. But he is somehow different, so that people kind of have to do a double take. And he has to say, it's me. And they go, oh, yes, of course it's you. But it takes a minute to kind of snap into this new reality. It's him, but it's a better him. With Jesus, the scars are even there. He gets like, no, see, it's me. And yet he is somehow better for it. So it's a difficult picture, but I think if you get kids to go plant a seed, you can talk about it, as that's the concept that God gives us of the resurrection. Or you can talk about anything else that changed. Little kids love to learn about butterflies. I mean, that's just cool. That's one of nature's greatest metaphors of transformation. Listen to what Paul says in another passage. So it is with the resurrection of the dead. Same chapter. What is sown is perishable. What is raised is imperishable. It is sown in dishonor. It is raised in glory. It is sown in weakness. It is raised in power. It is sown a natural body. It is raised a spiritual body. If there is a natural body, there is also a spiritual body. We're going to put one thing in. We bury one thing and God brings something better out. It's still you. And the grave is empty. The body comes up. But it's a body plus. It's a body made new. It's an incredible body. And so it's the caterpillar story. It's becoming the butterfly. It's something more beautiful in the image of God after the resurrection. So that's a way of talking about it that avoids zombie apocalypse, right? Because this is fun. When you think about it, how do modern people... Our culture's fascination with zombies has to do with the fact that we have this cultural knowledge of the concept of resurrection. But in our minds, you know, we're kind of secular people. We don't have anything to make that sound good. And so the zombie apocalypse fascination that we have, that's in so many movies, and I'm not even criticizing it, is kind of like this parody of, if we were in charge of the resurrection, that's the way it would be, right? Nasty looking corpses coming out of the ground to eat us. Right? And Paul has to say, no, that's not what God is doing. You're not in charge of the resurrection. Thank God you're not in charge of the resurrection. It's going to be something beautiful like this. We'll be raised like Jesus. Again, the resurrection chapter is 1 Corinthians 15. If you want to just read, study that chapter. Two things he says there. But in fact, Christ has been raised from the dead, the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. Just as we have borne the image of the man of dust, we shall also bear the image of the man of heaven. So whatever, Jesus is not kind of resurrected, he is completely resurrected. That is what I'm hoping for. Right? It's not something else. You can think of the resurrection as having already started, in the sense that body number one is out of the ground and was put on display for you to see. That's what we're waiting for. So in the same way you've been looking like Adam, you'll now look like Jesus. He's the new Adam. He's the new paradigm around which we'll be constructed. You're going to look like him. So, again, how does Jesus look when he comes out of the grave? It's him, but better in some way. And then judgment. How do we talk about judgment? Judgment can be a really scary concept for kids, and so I think we have to tread lightly here. Again, I don't want them to be terrified that when Jesus comes back, we're going to get in trouble, right? But it's possible that when Jesus comes back, you're going to get in trouble. I mean, that's a possibility, okay? So can I tell you my story? This last week, I was at a seminar in Kansas City. And my last job before I drove to Kansas City was to let Lucas off at school. So what does father say to his son when he knows he's going to be gone? You're the man of the house now. You know, you give the talking. You're going to be there. I want you to know. Mind your mother. I don't want any trouble. Rita's going to be taking up school. Make sure you do what Rita says. Take care of little brother. Behave yourself while I'm gone. So, of course, Lucas gets after school detention this week. Like, for the first time in his life, right? And, of course, while I'm in Kansas City, right, that's when he decides he's going to, I don't know, punch some kid in the face or something. It's still unclear exactly what happened, but something bad went down, apparently repeatedly. So, he gets after school detention, and they schedule it for Friday. Guess who gets to pick him up from school on Friday? Yeah. So he's not worried about detention. He's worried about dad picking him up from detention and how that conversation goes. And I'm glad. Apparently, he was telling mom how concerned he was that I would be picking him up Friday afternoon. That's great. I'm worried about, you know, am I a bad father? What have I done? I failed this child. And he's terrified that I'm going to murder him on Friday afternoon, which means I'm probably doing it right, is kind of what I'm thinking. So some sense of judgment, it's good for kids to have some sense of that, that there are things you're supposed to do and there are things you're not supposed to do. And yeah, the wrath of God comes down the mountain in the form of your dad and mom if you don't do them. there's some accountability there that has to happen. Maybe it's as simple as chores. You've been given a job to do. Anybody got chore charts for the kids? Get a chore chart. Chore charts are fun, right? We do ours for a while, then we stop, and then we realize, oh, we're not doing chores. We bring out the chore chart again. We go back and forth. We're not real consistent about it. But you give them a job. And then what happens if the job isn't done? You have to do something about it. Okay, that's why parents probably don't do chore charts. It's because they think, I'm going to do a chore chart, and then the kids are going to do it. Actually, no. You're going to do a chore chart, and they're not going to do it. And then you have to be a parent, right? And then you have to talk about, there are consequences for this behavior. Okay. So Saturday, young man is cleaning our house from top to bottom. This is so boring. I said, yeah, I wonder why you're having to do this. Well, you're not helping. Yeah, I didn't get attention. Right. So you have some kind of consequence that says you did a thing, now you do a thing, right? When your parents come home, they are happy if you have done what you were told, right? I wanted nothing more than, after not seeing my kids for a week, to come home and just hug them and play video games and hang out and eat junk food and be the most awesome dad. And instead, I get to be bad cop, right? That's no fun. It doesn't make me happy, as Calvin would say. That don't make me happy. Okay. But not doing chores makes parents unhappy. There's no way around that, okay? Jesus has given us some work to do. And he's given us our whole lives to do it. So if you give a kid an hour to do something, when will they do it? Minute 59, right? That's when they're going to say, oh, yeah, I better go ahead and give it to that, right? And we seem to do that with Jesus' work, right? Yeah. Well, after I've taken care of myself and raised my family and done all the things I want to do and vacation and things I want to do in life, you know, then I'll do some of that Jesus stuff, right? And it's important for kids to learn, both at home and then more broadly, that we're responsible for doing things. So let's get to it. And when we do that, there's nothing to fear. Jesus is coming back is a homecoming instead of the wrath of God coming down the mountain at us. Beyond that, the Bible doesn't give us a lot of picture of judgment except that it will happen. The chore we have been given by Jesus is living with love for God and our fellow man. And there's a whole book about it. It's called the Bible. And it tells you how to go about it. But when you read the judgment passages, it's usually not even about the stuff we care about. I think it's very important for you to be here to worship on Sunday. But when Jesus describes worship, he doesn't talk about Sunday. He says, did you take care of people that were in need? Did you help other people? Were you kind? Were you loving? That's the story he tells. And so while I do believe Sunday is very important, it's not the thing that comes up. What comes up is, what have you done with the life God has given you? Have you done your task of living with love for God and your fellow man? And he says he will know if we did it or not. Right? There is no like sneaking around and maybe dad will find out. Mom always knows. She's omniscient. It's frightening, right? Mom always knows. And the way Jesus describes it is the sheep and goat story. So if you want to do some reading tonight of kind of thinking of how you want to think about this concept, Matthew 25, 31 to 46, he tells a judgment story, but it's sheep and goats. And just as a shepherd can tell the difference between a sheep and a goat, Jesus says, I'll know the difference when I look at you, on kind of how you've spent your life. So, feedback now. We've got a few minutes left. How do you talk to kids about that? How do you balance teaching them responsibility and, yes, God holds you accountable for your life with, I want them to be happy that Jesus is coming back and not, like, terrified that the bad cop is going to arrive and arrest us all. Anybody had that conversation yet? Anybody talking about that topic? Well, you all fail. Just kidding. No. I remember because Dad talked about stuff, random stuff like that. He was a preacher, and we talk about it a lot. I remember being frightened of heaven. Because God was like, hold me accountable. And even if I pass the test, then, you know, who knows what happens in heaven? It's this big, scary place with God in it. I like being concerned about how that would work out. And so I think maybe we can do better than that somehow. Ma'am.
I'll tell you what I did. So my kids are extremely literal. I figured out
But yes. We were having a conversation one day, and I talked about how, you know, or we were reading the passage, you're talking about, you know, the elements melting, and, you know, the earth is going to be destroyed.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Like, they, cult just latched onto that, and it's like, but I like the earth.
Yeah.
Why is it going to be destroyed? Where's it gonna, well, there's going to be a new, better one, but I want this one. And yeah. I'm like, great.
Yeah, that's that is great. Remember that conversation, because next week I want to talk about that exact point. Because the Bible does give you two kind of weird pictures of what happens after this. And somehow I'm convinced they're both true, but they sound very different. One of them sounds like everything burns and we all start over. And the other one, there are passages that talk about what he says, new heavens and new earth, like it's this 2.0, like it is continuing in some way. In some way, just like the body comes back, but it's new body, it's the same new body. In the same way, the Bible describes where we go next, it is kind of a new earth, but it's not earth, right? And that there is a burning. There is something that was not supposed to be here anyway that goes away. And what heaven is being with God, and it will kind of be like the best parts of this life, but not the same. And the Bible is just really confusing in explaining that, because it's trying to explain something you couldn't possibly know, right? You've never been there.
I think a lot about people that have pasture land.
Hmm.
What do they do every so often? They burn it.
Yeah.
Why do they burn it? To get rid of the unwanted weeds, to let the Bermuda grass grow back. And after
it comes back green and beautiful. Yeah.
And, I mean, after you've done that, then that pasture is really good.
That's a good metaphor. I may steal that for next week, because that seems to be kind of the picture, that yes, in a sense, everything goes away. In a sense, something far better, and there's a connection between what is far better and what we have now. That's difficult. The most important point, we'll get to this next week, this is my big point next week, is the reason the Bible doesn't give you super elaborate details about what is to come. Number one, you couldn't understand it. And number two, the place doesn't matter. If heaven was in Texas or in Central America, you wouldn't care. All that matters is who is there. It's the place where God is. And where it ends up and what it looks like on the map. I mean, if you read our hymnal, you would think we are the most vain, materialistic people on the planet, right? There's going to be a street of gold, and I'm going to have a mansion, and I'm going to, right? And I promise you, that is not what you're going to care about in the world to come. You're going to be with God, and you don't care if it is a tent, right? You don't care if it is a cardboard box next to God's throne. You're going to say, this is fantastic. It's the best box I've ever seen. And that's the idea. We just have to learn to be more like Tom and not be materialistic. Tom made some kind of snarky remark about, I'm not materialistic, I don't need anything for my birthday. Which is a great way to get lots of birthday presents. Any other thoughts or comments before we wrap it up? Land the plane. Okay, thank you.